So again, it's important that we, in our own way, each of us, find that place of stillness within oneself, within one's body, within one's mind. One has a place, a known, felt place within oneself to live from. If we don't have that inner place of stillness or calmness or centeredness or groundedness, whatever we want to say, within us, then it's very difficult to not get tossed about by the ups and downs, back and forth situations of life, as well as tossed about by our own endlessly bifurcating thoughts and feelings that are constantly arising. So in this world of constant arisings and passings and change and impermanence, etc., we need to find that place within ourselves. Many people try to find it outside themselves, and therefore often experience whatever it is that they were relying on for stability no longer is there. They feel very unstable. They feel like the rug has been pulled out from under them. They feel confused, lost, and they quickly have to scramble about to find something else external to grab on. And that's a situation, unfortunately, with most people. But it creates a lot of turmoil, creates a lot of emotional disturbance, and it takes a lot of energy. Much simpler to spend a little time establishing that sense of stillness or finding that place of stillness, calmness, groundedness, stability, whatever, within one's own body, mind. Right? And then the passing parade of thoughts, positive, negative, of emotions of all types, and as well as the ups and downs and back and forth of life in general, ordinary life, no longer is what we are so caught up in. So we're able to go through our day and go through our life with much greater equanimity. You know, people say they want equanimity. They want peace of mind, right? I mean, many people say they'd love to have that. Well, it's not that difficult to really get, to be honest. I mean, it's not something extraordinary, or it's not something that one needs to, you know, become a mystic or a full-time meditator or anything like that. But one does have to make some shifts, and basically one has to make a shift away from those things in one life that is causing one to always feel unstable, uncalm, not peaceful, right? And at the same time, to stop doing those things that create that sense of discomfort inside oneself, and to begin to spend some time cultivating the capacity to have a ground. And again, to find a ground within yourself, to find peace and stability within oneself, is also, in these times of financial hardship, you know, and difficulty, very inexpensive. So for those of you who are concerned about, you know, cutting back on expenses, you know, there are many things that people do activities they participate in, things they buy, because they think that by doing all these activities or finding these things, they'll be happy. And again, that can mount up over time. You know, many people are in debt not simply because they're in debt because of just survival. Some people are having to go into debt, unfortunately, just to survive. But many people are in debt because of their because they're using things and activities to for emotional needs, right? And that that can be costly. Unfortunately, not only costly emotionally, but it can be costly financially. How much better to be someone who is more self-reliant, who's more, has a greater capacity to know that they can find peace and happiness in the utter simplicity of being alive and with the simple things of a natural life and relationships and things like that, much happiness and well-being can be found. Right? Much easier and much less running around and much less risky. So even these things like we're doing tonight, meditation and mindfulness, have very real-world applications that I think many of us could find that can be very applicable and effective for making our own lives, even, as I say, in the financial realm or other ways, much more easier to attain. Anyhow, I don't. That's just a thought popped into my head. But anyhow, before we get into our formal teaching tonight, we always begin with an opportunity. If anyone has any questions about the actual practices of mindfulness and meditation, or any questions about the things that I was just talking about. I mean, not specifically that, but just, you know, how do we bring these practices into our life to create greater meaning or peace or happiness? These things are not always readily apparent, and many of us ponder these things. So if anybody has any questions, please feel free to ask whatever. Don't be shy. Yes.
Will you talk a little about dealing with physical pain when we're meditating, or perhaps when we're not meditating?
Yeah. You know, one of the downsides of having a human body, there are many upsides, right, to having a human body. But one of the downsides of our human body is it doesn't take much to make it uncomfortable, right? And that just seems to be a part of the process. Of having a human body. At the same time, therefore undertaking something like, you know, what we're doing here, sitting meditation. For those of us who have grown up in society where we don't usually sit cross-legged, you know, without support, the way we do here, will naturally lead to some degree of uncomfortableness, right? For starters. And obviously, when the longer we sit, in a position that is somewhat uncomfortable to us, that which begins as uncomfortable can become painful. Right? And again, please let me make sure that you understand that being uncomfortable and experiencing pain is not the object of the practice. And so if that is what's unfolding for you when you're sitting, again, there are half a dozen different ways of sitting. You look around, you see people, different kinds of postures, as well as always, using a back jack or sitting in a chair. Right? So, but having said that, my own experience, and I think the experience of many others, is there is something interesting and perhaps helpful to be learned in dealing with physical discomfort. Because the physical discomfort is not just something we experience again when we're learning how to sit in meditation and stretch our body accordingly. It's something we experience in many other ways. And usually our experience when we are experiencing physical discomfort is to immediately get rid of it. Right? You know, there is an incredible incredible large industry, right, involved with the immediate remediation of people's pain, you know, such as all kinds of aspirins and pain relievers, you know, and then it gets higher and higher. But they're all in the service of what? Immediately getting rid of our physical discomfort, whether it's in our head or other places in our body. It is interesting to observe what happens when we begin to experience discomfort or uncomfortableness in our body mind, and whether that is the physical, which is you're asking about, but as well for many people it is the emotional. Right? Many people are as uncomfortable, if not more uncomfortable, with emotional pain as well as physical. And often the same way, we immediately want to do something to get rid of it, discharge it. So learning a different way to relate to that which is called pain or discomfort, I think it'd be very meaningful. Because again, one of the things to notice is, as we said, is that immediately when we experience, we almost immediately want to move to do something about it. In the same way, when we often experience emotional pain, the first thing we want to do is do something about it. Do something else, or take a drink, or go shopping, or go turn on the TV, or run away. Or, you know what I mean? There are all kinds of things that we do. And we do the same thing when we're sitting on the cushion. So the capacity to be present, right? And to bring our awareness and mindfulness to actually what is being experienced. Because I think what we notice is that when we have physical discomfort, and I think you would grant me that physical discomfort means we are experiencing simply sensations in our body, right, that we are labeling as uncomfortable. Most of the time, these are not life-threatening, right? Nor are they crippling, right? They are uncomfortable. I mean, please, if you're experiencing something that you believe is crippling, please take a different posture, okay? But most of the time, we're just experiencing something that we might label as an uncomfortable sensation in our body. Well within the reins of doing no harm, but yet uncomfortable, right? Again, rather than immediately trying to do something about that, it is often interesting to learn how two things. One is just to be present in awareness to the sensation, and rather than tightening, to relax, right? And secondly, to watch that in response to that physical sensation of uncomfortability, how the mind immediately begins to obsess, right? Create a story around it, and just like, nothing else matters, but our, of this pain, or this discomfort, and we start thinking about it, and, what can I do about it, and how can I get it to, or what am I doing here, or... And I think what we would notice, very interesting, is the way we respond to the discomfort that may arise and probably often will arise if we sit for any length of time in our body is often what we kind of habitually do with discomfort of body and mind in other parts of our life, right? So the instruction of simply be aware, be mindful, and relax, right? And do not let the mind be disturbed by physical discomfort. In other words, rather than constricting into the pain and sensation to create spaciousness around it. Again, until you've actually done it, and maybe there are many people here who've done it, it's hard to believe it because we're so used to just constricting and obsessing. Right, it's kind of a physical constriction and a mental obsession that happens. And if we can learn just to be very relaxed and open, create spaciousness, and not let the mind obsess about it, I think there's a lot to be learned about, again, how we interact with ourselves. Many of us are strangers to our own bodies, right? We're also maybe many of us strangers to our own minds, so that's why we immediately go take something, because we don't know how to relax or soften ourselves, right? We are kind of in a way alienated from our own physicality. Now again, I'm speaking within the context of a learning curve, okay? Please understand, I am not speaking the concept of doing harm to your body, all right, or going out of your way. But I guess what I'm saying is, again, because most of us, have not grown up this way, and if we do want to learn how to sit in some sort of cross-legged posture, and there are many different kinds, there's bound to be some discomfort, You know, there's no getting away with it. It doesn't mean that, you know, doing stretching or other kinds of yogic things, you know, to loosen up and soften the body may not, you know, help us. But there's bound to be discomfort. And I guess there's a way where we can play with it that can be beneficial to us. Does that answer your question? Thank you, Jay. Any other questions about practice? Good. What would you like to talk about? Any suggestions before I begin? Is there anybody who would like to suggest a topic? Just because I brought one doesn't mean I have to be the boss. Anybody have a topic they'd like to be presented on? Yes. Oh.
I would like to hear you speak about cause and effect.
About cause and effect. And in terms of what? I mean, that's a big one. That might be bigger than the one that Doug didn't talk about. Doug may want to reconsider what he was going to ask when he heard what Alex's was. I mean, how would you... can you give me a little frame around that?
Well, you know, we have aspects of cause and effect that... they're constantly playing off one another, and you don't have that linear, this is the cause, this is the effect. It's constantly overlapping and it's integrated, but we use terms that have cause and effect, craving, desire, grasping, aversion, things that are all tied up into cause and effect that it... I think it would be helpful for me if I heard you talk about it in a way of trying to integrate it so that it wasn't seemingly so unrelated but related.
Okay, sorry. So I'm not sure what I understand, but let me say a few things, what comes up, and then maybe you can sharpen me a bit. So what Alex is talking about is what in Buddhism is called karma. I mean, you probably all heard karma. It's become a pop term. But again, it really has to do with a fundamental way of looking at life, which is that life is not random, right? Nor is life something that is, nor is our life the plaything of gods or other external forces. But that basically everything that happens in life is happening because of a cause. There's causation, right? And every cause creates an effect. And that this is the operant law of life. Cause and effect. Which means then if whatever you're looking at in life now, whether it's your own personal life, whether it's somebody else's personal life, or whether it's the life of the world, right? The answer always to why is this happening, right? Whatever that happening is, why is this happening? The answer is always because of what? Prior effects, prior causes, right? Because of this, that is occurring, right? And that which is occurring was also going to be creating future effects. So it's an endless movement of life, of moving from causation to effect. Now, that in one hand promotes us to no longer ask always why. Why are people the way they are? Right? Because of causes, right? Why is Brian the way he is? Because of causes. What are the causes? If we could look at Brian's life and know everything that he's been exposed to in life and everything he has done, right, in body, speech, and mind and all that, which, as Alex pointed out, is not just one, it's myriad, right? We could understand exactly why Brian is sitting here like this with his legs like he is. Right? It's all led up to this moment. And if we took it all apart and could really pull it all apart, we could actually see what it is in Brian's life, the reason he's not in the Mexican restaurant tonight, the reason he's not out smoking crack tonight, the reason he's not, whatever. We'd understand why he's here. Is that clear? And the same for all of us. Right? We understand that there are, and again, there are myriad causes and effects. Some are very central, right? But also, the interesting thing is all the causes, all the people that have affected Brian, right? They all have myriad causes and effects that have moved Ev along. So we can see that in a certain way it is understandable, but in another way we can see it is a mystery because there's so many things are moving through each of us, right? I mean, each of us right now, we are right now in the present, we have physical effects, right, of our ancestors, of our life, that is all playing out within our body, and within our organs. You know, right here as we speak, our body is manifesting the effects of all kinds of causes, right, that we don't even know about that are unfolding in our life, as well as most of us, you know, do not know the whole movement of our life and where it's going and what it's going through. But all we know is that, what? It is unfolding according to causes and conditions, right? Social conditions, right? You may have had an interest in learning about meditation. You may have heard about it. Your causes and effects are moving in your life, and then all of a sudden you hear about this as a meditation group, you know, so and so, right? And the meditation group has all its causes and effects, how it formed, and how it, you know, and all of a sudden it comes together, and right? But yet, cause and effect now. Not only does cause and effect get us away from so much of what we do in terms of denial, in terms of not understanding, in terms of shock, in terms of anger, in terms of lots of stuff, because we understand that there are causes supporting it, right? That's one whole piece. The other piece is things can change. Because this is no fixed world, because it's a world of many causes and conditions, and that one cause creates an effect and another cause creates another effect, I always have the capacity of what? Change. I can change in two ways. Well, I can change in many ways, but I mean, two ways that come to me immediately is many effects are ripening in me in my life that are supported by causation from the past, right? Whether it's in relationship to people, situations, my own mental formations, right? Who I am, personality, all that, right? We could say many things come together in who I am right now and how I manifest that I cannot help but expressing or experiencing in the moment, right? In the present. But I have my freedom is that I don't have to respond the way I always have, right? So this cause and effect, while it's a movement in life, right? It is not fixed, right? So if I've always learned to respond when I'm angry at someone to hit them, right? That's always been my way of discharging my anger. I can learn what? Another way of responding to my anger. It doesn't mean that my anger will not continue to arise as a cause, but the way I respond to it will change its effect on me. Is that clear? I just use that as one strong example, but that means that we often cannot change our past, which is causing us to feel a certain way, see things a certain way, react to things a certain way, etc., right? But I can learn how, when these things arise in me, I don't go with certain ones, right? At all. As well as, part two is, now that I understand the way this life operates, I can be much more conscious in how I am behaving, how I'm speaking, and how I'm thinking, right? Because I know that that is very much the determination, right? I am setting causes for effects in the future. So this is very important in terms of healing and transformation, which I think many of us are seeking. We cannot change our past, right? For good or bad. And it will continue to ripen within us because we have many causes that are pushing us. Karma. This is our karma. But because karma is not a fixed thing, I can learn that when my past arises in me, I can respond differently. So therefore, I am lessening the control of my past on my present. As well as, I can learn a whole new repertoire of skills, of ways of thinking, of ways of acting, of ways of, you know, seeing things, which also facilitates that my future will be different. Right? Now, when you put those two together, you have a good, a good vortex for meaningful transformation. Right? But to be able to do that, one needs awareness, mindfulness. One has to be able to have some objectivity about the things that are arising within us, so we can respond differently. To respond differently, let's come back to the guy who immediately feels anger, he lashes out, right? That is not going to change unless what? He can surround that anger with what? Mindfulness, awareness. Oh, I know there's anger in me. Right? Also understanding. I know in the past when there was anger with me, I always did this, but I am going to now do that. So you put those two together, it's very powerful. And we know, not just in the spiritual world, but we know many people have had the capacity to turn their life. We talk about people turning their life around, right? Well, this person really turned their life around, right? They were headed here, but they went there. Well, how'd they do that? Something clicked at some point. Something clicked that they, just because their past has been a certain way, they don't have to keep going with that, as well as they might have very clearly went out and learned a whole new way of being in life, right? Now, so that's... Now, your question was in terms of what? I mean, does that answer what you were getting at?
Well, it was a wonderful discussion, and I wasn't getting at something so specific. Hmm. Occasionally, I'm told, by someone, this happened for a reason. I know it happened for a reason.
Like, meaning what?
Like, there's some force in the unexplainable mystery of the world that caused this to happen the way it did, and that it was for a reason. There are people that have that maybe it's a religious bent or a spiritual bent,
where they believe
that there's something that was directly the result of some force that determined that this was going to happen the way it did, as opposed to it was a spontaneous event that just happened.
Right. And again, I would say it's a third, which is it is not preordained by some force outside ourselves that ordained that to happen, so we could learn a lesson. Nor is it just a spontaneous combustion. It is causation that is causing whatever happened to happen. Now again, whether that keeps happening in someone's life and there's a lesson to be learned, you know, that could be. But that's something that we distill from that experience, right? I mean, again, you know, we could say, well, this keeps happening to me. There's obviously a lesson here. Yeah, but the idea that somebody's trying to teach you that lesson, you know, your life is teaching you. I mean, life is always trying to wake us up. And we often see see the patterns of our life, you know, when we see situations constantly repeated. But again, this goes back to the Buddha. I mean, he really established his Dharma on cause and effect, right? Which again is like a middle ground between, you know, the gods are playing with us, and we are just the playthings of the god. There's some other kind of force that's kind of preordaining all this, or, you know, manipulating all this, as well as this idea that it's just a totally spontaneous, random universe. There's no way of, you know, it's like just out of control. No, there is a mechanism here. It's cause and effect. But again, it's cause and effect. Karma is not just individual, right? I mean, like, in a certain sense, we're in this together, right? So we might say the unfolding of the world in terms of the way masses of people or whatever have used resources and fossil fuels and all that, you know, where we're all experiencing, the whole world will experience the effects of global warming, right? I mean, just because we're a human being. So there's what's called collective karma. We don't like that, right? You know, I mean, I think what's going on in our country politically is now everybody's trying to go, I don't want to be in a country with you, right? You know, we want to deny that we're collectively involved with one another. Everybody wants to go, you know, it's the opposite of understanding that somehow, you know, collectively we are connected, and that somehow we have to accept one another and learn how to work with one another for common goals or whatever. But there's such ignorance of that. And again, I think it's because people don't see there's a collective karma. You know, for better or worse, we're kind of stuck with each other in this world. You know, people can say, well, you know, I don't contribute to global warming. I drive a Prius, right? You know, I only turn on my irrigation system once a week like I'm supposed to. I'm not one of these people who turn it on four times a week. Right? But that's good. But again, we have collective karma. That's why we understand that if we want, you know, a different world and relate to the world in a different way, we have to, unfortunately, reach out to many people, right? That the transformation cannot come just by my own purity of intention in life. You know, we're in this together. That's often frustrating to people, right? You know, why'd this happen to me? I'm a good guy, right? You know, I don't drink and drive. Why do I get hit by a drunk driver? It seems what? Unfair, doesn't it? And at a certain level, it is unfair. But unfortunately, the truth is we are in this world together, and we, you know, we reap all kinds of effects. You know, somebody once, I remember once talking to somebody, and they were telling me this story about, you know, somebody was, it was like that, sort of in a car driving, you know, young people or whatever, and somebody just came out of nowhere and hit him and killed him. And they said, you know, it's all so unfair, you know, and the karma was all the other person's, you know, the one who killed him. But the truth is what? I made a choice to what? To get in the car, right? I have to take responsibility that I got in the car and I was driving. If I wasn't in the car and driving, that person would not have hit me. It doesn't mean I have the cause for the damage, but I do have to take responsibility, right? that I, it was my volition to be where I was. You know, and that's an interesting way of looking at things, because we often don't want to take any responsibility. You know, I remember, you know, years ago when I used to do a lot of marital therapy, you know, people, you know, when people are in conflict, they don't talk nicely about each other. You might have noticed. And they go, you know, something like, you know, how, what am I doing with this person? Am I responsible? I don't know, you know, you married them. I mean you got to take responsibility for that. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know what I mean, you were forced into it. But people act this way. You know, we don't want to take responsibility. Yes, that is true. You know, it doesn't mean, again, that change is impossible and all that, but we again try to step out of our own responsibility, which is often a responsibility even when we're the innocent, right? And even when there is a perpetrator. There is some connection that I am there. And that I think is helpful, because then it makes me understand that there is, even in all situations, you know, there's freedom. I was telling somebody today, I was recalling this this wonderful Tibetan teacher I once met, just a light bulb of a man. He spent 20 years in a Chinese prison, communist Chinese prison, solely because he was a teacher, you know, Buddhist teacher, and during the time of the Cultural Revolution, and when the communists had taken over Tibet, they were very harsh to the teachers, because they would want to, one, stamp out Buddhism, but they also knew that these people were very much leaders of their community. So anyhow, this guy spends 20 years in a horrible prison. Now, we know, right, what that kind of life does to people, right? You know what it did to this guy? And he was deprived, he was starved, he was tortured a little bit, he was, right? You know what it did to him? He thought it was the one most wonderful opportunity. Right? He said, because I heard him, I met him once, and he said, you know, if I had stayed in the monastery, I would have been very, I was always so busy there. So many activities, so much to do. He said, the 20 years I was in prison, I had lots of time just to practice. There was nobody bothering me, you know, about duties or anything. So he said, I could really focus on my meditation practice without a lot of disturbance. And then he said, it was a wonderful thing, because in the part of the prison that I was in, they had put all these other teachers. So I said, I met teachers that I would have never had the opportunity to meet. You know, people from other traditions and other teachings, and we exchanged different lineages. I mean, it kind of blew my mind. You know, because you would expect that somebody in that situation would be what? Despairing, embittered, angry. And he said, also it gave me a great opportunity to practice patience and loving kindness toward the people who had captured me and had imprisoned me, you know, to bear them no ill will, and to understand that it was only causes and conditions that were causing them to do what, you know. And he said, whatever I did, we always did our best to be kind to them, even when they mistreated us. And he said, over time, it began to have some effect. Some of them really began to change how they treated us. And so it was this. Again, I use that as an example to say, yes, even in the most negative situations, people can, even though they're reaping the effects of past causes, how they respond to that. And here I'm using that as an example of somebody in a very incredibly painful negative situation that would do most of us in, right? He used it just to facilitate a deeper transformation. I mean, and this guy, I met him after 20 years. He was a light bulb, just the sweetest, kindest. And it was probably, you know, I would imagine that he's probably much more than he was 20 years ago. In a way, prison softened him. And we know for most people, prison what? Hardens you. So it's, again, I'm not, please understand, I am not standing up for incarceration of people. But I'm just saying, it's just interesting that you take similar people reaping the same karma, and somebody works it this way, and somebody else can work it a totally different way. And I think all the situations of our life, we can see that, right? And again, whether you know, again, whether you see what's happening or unfolding to you as a lesson that some preordained force is kind of giving you special to Alex, this is your homework for the, you know, for these 10 years, or whether you just see it just from your own unfolding because the situation has a potential to cause you suffering, and you say, I don't want to do it this way anymore. You know, it's like your choice to transform, to respond differently. Any other questions? Yes.
In relation to what you're talking about, I'm obviously around children.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that, and is there a way to sort of help them start to see that? Particularly
12 and 13-year-olds, yeah.
They don't seem to see that they have options.
Yeah, I mean, Kate, you're probably better to answer that than myself. I'm not a teacher. I mean, I did have children who were 12 and 13. I know I can empathize with you. Even if they've been exposed to the best things in life, they do have a way of becoming a complete pain in the you-know-what at that stage of life. You know, sometimes people change because they get it themselves, right? Something just awakens in themselves, enough suffering, enough whatever, right, that they choose, they wake up one day and say, you know, I'm going to do it differently, right? Other people, they meet somebody, right, who either models it for them or educates them in a way, teaches them in a way, that shows them in another way. You know, there is another way because, you know, that option never came up in their own experience. I think the latter is usually more the case. Right? And I think, you know, if you think about Buddhism, you know, the path of Buddha or Christ or any great spiritual leader, right, or transformative leader, even in the social sphere, right, we know that their power comes from what? They show people another way. And they show people another way that for the people involved, until this person kind of really put it to them, right? They never would have thought it. Or if they thought it, they would have never seen it was possible. So again, you know, whether you're Martin Luther King or a Gandhi or, you know, or something like that, or whether you're just Kate in a classroom, it's in a certain way the same thing you're trying to do. And I think to be clear that that's you know, that's part of education. You know, I think some of you saw Shantam Seth, you know, when he was here, and from India, and we had him speak at the Lotus Room. But, you know, one of the things he's been talking about, he's gotten involved in India, and now he's trying to do it more internationally, is this whole idea of mindfulness in education. But when I asked him really what that meant, you know, is it just teaching teachers, you know, how to meditate, mindfulness, he says, no, it's really, the whole movement is about that education has gone off the skids because it doesn't, it only teaches, it's only about learning information. And it's not really looking at the needs of the whole child. And again, we're not talking about religious needs, you know, but we're talking about just what you're saying. I mean, you know, the capacity to understand their mind and to understand, you know, the questions that Alex, you know, asked, which is, you know, many people, when you talk to them about changing, they say what? You know, I can't change. I am the way I am, right? And that's nonsense. Because I've never, I mean, you know, well, look at Alex. I can assure you that when Alex came out of his mother's womb, he wasn't like this. Right? I mean, you know, so Alex was formed over many years, right? And so we think that the way we think and the way we view things and the way we act are sort of like predestined, or that's who I am. But that's not true. I mean, most of us, if we look more deeply in the situation, would see how deeply we have been affected in our life, positively and negatively. And when you understand that, you really realize if you are becoming more self-aware and you do develop a process of awareness and mindfulness, that you can actually see these things objectively, you realize there's lots that can be changed. Right? Again, you know, I don't know about you, but I think, you know, when I think back over, you know, meaningful teachers I've had in my life, they're not just the ones who gave me the most information, right? I mean, I think those could have been good information teachers, you know. But I think when we think back of the teachers, if we're lucky enough to have teachers that were really meaningful, it was the personal connection. They touched something in us. They showed us something about life, right, that was meaningful. And that, I think that's really what education should be about. I mean, obviously, it has to be somewhat a transmission of knowledge and information and skills and all those things. But, you know, if you don't, if we're not transmitting, you know, self-awareness and children learning to be in touch with themselves as human beings and to know their capacities and potentials, right, which is more than how either their family of origin or their neighborhood or their, you know, background has conditioned them, I think we're doing them a disservice. Obviously, to children who've had wonderful opportunities in life, that's not the issue. But when we see children that have been really twisted and constricted by their upbringing, you know, who else is going to do it? And as you can see, you know, the longer we wait, the more difficult the task gets. Right? Again, it doesn't mean that 20-year-olds can't transform and turn their lives around, and 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds, you know, many of us are in that category. But it does seem to come less and less. So, again, you know, even though I'm, you know, I think you understand what I'm saying. I think it's... I mean, I think that's a good teacher. You know, you want to inspire kids about life, about who they are, and about who they, you know, who they can be. And if you see kids who have been wounded in life already, you know, that already they're cynical, already they're disheartened, already they're despairing, already they're so angry, close down, you know, you want to reach out to them. I mean, that's part of the job, isn't it? Yeah. You know, this is, why don't we just do a little of what I was going to do tonight? This is called the Way of the Bodhisattva. And for those of you who are not aware, within our larger community, the Florida Community of Mindfulness, of which the Tampa group is just a local group, we do these things called intensives. And they're kind of 3 and 6 month periods of kind of more intense practice, where we, the people who join it, make a series of commitments, such as whatever the topic is, that they'll do all the readings, that they'll meditate formally for an hour a day, that they'll, I have calls, individual calls with them, they have small group discussions. So anyhow, it's something that we do within our practice community to help people who want to deepen their practice, but also have jobs, families, etc., to deepen their understanding and practice. So now we're doing a 6 month intensive. It's actually going to last close to 8 months on this text called "The Way of the Bodhisattva" by Shantideva. This is one of the great, wondrous texts in Buddhism that elucidates what's called the path of the Bodhisattva. So, and it's quite a profound text. It's all verse, and this is the people in the intensive are reading the text, plus there are about 3 or 4 commentaries by different authors that are also part of it. Shantideva himself was a 8th century, he lived in India. He was a monk at Nalanda University. If you know anything about Indian history, there were these great, at this time, these great Buddhist universities, sort of like Harvard and Yale and Stanford. But then these Buddhist universities weren't just only for, Buddhist teachings. I mean, lots of various kinds of philosophy and art and poetry and logic and medicine and all these things and meditation, were all in these universities. So Shantideva was at Nalanda, which was one of the great Indian Buddhist universities at the time. But he was, he kind of kept to himself. But most of the monks that were in his college or whatever didn't like him. They actually had a name for him. I forget what it was, but it basically meant all he does was sleep, eat, and shit. So they really thought he was, he was... anyhow, he was a complete embarrassment to the to his fellow students in the college, and they really just would always go to the abbot or the head proctor or something and say, get rid of him. He's just this is all he does all day. He's worthless. So they kept going to the abbot, and he kept saying, no, he's okay. The abbot obviously knew him. So finally, they thought they had this plan. Well, we'll just publicly humiliate him so that it'll be clear to everybody, including the abbot, that this guy has got to be thrown out. So they set up this thing where Shantideva would be invited to give a talk on Buddhist teachings, and they just knew that he would so embarrass himself. It would be so embarrassing by what he would say that the abbot would get rid of him, and so. So they, went to him, requested, and sort of he said, "All right." It comes. The day of the thing comes, I forget. He's up there, and they say something like, and he says to them, "Do you want me to talk about such and such a subject in terms of this and that, or do you want me just to give you my own teaching?" I mean, they were kind of like flabbergasted, I mean, not only was he, but now he wants to give his own teaching. They thought he was a complete failure in terms of learning anything, but now this guy has so they thought, oh, this is great. Now he'll totally make an ass of himself, and we'll get him thrown out. So anyhow, supposedly what he did was he gave what this text is, this path of this Bodhicaryatara, or the path of the Bodhisattva, all in verse. And it obviously blew everybody away. It's even said that at one point when he was teaching the wisdom section, he levitated high into the air. And anyhow, if you read accounts of Shanti Devi's life, there's lots of this kind of almost mythological kinds of things. Actually, very little is known about him other than sort of this, that he basically, was at Nalanda University, that basically he taught this text. And there are really only two other, there's only one other writing that's even extant from him. This Bodhicaratara is also one of the, because when the Muslim invasions occurred later on in Indian history, they torched and destroyed all these monasteries. So much of the original text of Buddhism that hadn't been already transmitted to Tibet and China and translated were lost. But they actually do have some... his text is one of the few that they still have the original Sanskrit text from. So anyhow, this teaching on the Bodhisattva way has been preserved since the 8th century and is really just a wonderful... and I want to share a little bit, but let me just say something about... So this is called the Way of the Bodhisattva. And in the text... And I'm just going to pick... They're all like four-line verses. What Shantideva does in the first chapter, which is called The Excellence of Bodhicitta, is before he even talks about the path and the practices that one does, he wants to set forth what he considers most important, which is, I guess to put it simply, is to say... what is the purpose of my life? Why am I living? Right? And what Shantideva, and he says that I wrote this whole thing, or I said this whole thing, really for myself. This is really kind of a dialogue that he has with himself, so he makes sure that he really understands this path that he has been practicing in his life. And what he's expressing in this, what he calls bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word made up of two words, bodhi and citta. Citta really refers to mind or thought or intention. And bodhi has to do with enlightenment and awakening. So what this word bodhicitta means is that the mind that wants to awake, the mind that wants to be enlightened, the individual who has the thought of this and the intention to accomplish this is all involved in this word bodhicitta. Now, the other important thing, which is the other half of this word bodhicitta, and the word, and forgive me for talking Sanskrit to you, but you come across these terms. The other term is the bodhisattva, which is a being who was practicing bodhicitta, is, and this is, and this is, you'll see in the text, is what is the why am I doing this, right? Why am I undertaking this process of awakening within myself all the good and freeing myself from all that is dark, all that is egocentric, all that is emotionally immature and neurotic? Why am I freeing myself from all this egocentricity? And why am I freeing myself from all the pain-producing aspects of my life? And why do I want to awaken up all the wondrous capacities of a loving, compassionate, understanding, patient, human being. Why do I want to follow that path? And he says it is only for one purpose, and that is to be of benefit to others and to help others. Okay, this is very important. So he says the reason one undertakes this path, which has a lot to do with working on oneself, right, which one can perceive as fairly self-centered. He said the only purpose for doing that is because you want to benefit others. And why do you want to benefit others? Because you are inextricably connected, interconnected with everyone. Right? And so this text called The Way of the Bodhisattva is about, well, it's about people who undertake, it's how to undertake this path. But in this first chapter, he's really trying to inspire us, because he says, this is what has inspired me. It's sort of like, I was, kind of going along in life, taking care of my needs, working on my own goals and objectives, trying to find my own little piece of happiness or well-being or safety or security or stability in my own little world, like most of us. And he said, and all of a sudden, at one point, I encountered this Bodhisattva path, this vision of what it really means to be a human being, right? And he said, this has been so meaningful to me and has given my life such purpose and understanding and brought me such happiness that I want to share it with you. Now again, Shantideva is 8th century India, it's quite a text, he said. But we know these people, don't we? In our own life. There are people who appear in this life who seem to have a different agenda than the rest of us. And their different agenda is they are working for the well-being of all of us. Right? Does anybody know of anybody like that? In our own time, can you think of somebody? Mother Teresa, anybody else? Dalai Lama, anybody else? Thich Nhat Hanh, anybody else?
The three women
from Africa and Yemen who just won the Nobel Peace Prize. Anybody else? Bishop Tutu, anybody else?
Mahatma Gandhi.
Who else? Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, right? We know, and actually probably people in our own community, little people, not famous people, but people who seem that, who live their life so open-heartedly and compassionately, and their concern for others transcends selfishness, So selfishness, not in a bad way, but self-centeredness, which is the condition for most of us. So this is, I just want to give you a little context. We only have a few minutes. So let me just read some verses. This is an interesting verse. He says, just as on a dark night, black with clouds, the sudden lightning glares and all is clearly shown. Likewise, rarely through the Buddha's power, virtuous thoughts arise, brief and transient in the world. So there are many ways to interpret this, right? But we know that if we're out at night and it's dark, right? Well, we can't see anything, can we? But if there's a wonderful flash of lightning, for a minute we can see everything, can't we, clearly? All of a sudden everything's lit up and we can see everything that's there. But a minute later, what happens? It gets dark again. And so what he's saying is, whether it's in the world or whether it's in our own mind, the amount of time when these kinds of altruistic, virtuous kind of thought arises in us is very rare. that it arises by itself, right? Usually our thoughts are all self-concerned, right? Very rarely, on its own, will these types of altruistic thoughts arise. As he says, very rarely in the world does this kind of thinking arise. So he's saying how rare it is, but yet when it does arise within us as individuals, or does it arise in society, how meaningful it is. And that we should take note of them. Because if we don't, right, there may be many of us here who at various times in their life or at various moments in the day may feel a strong inspiration, a thought that one may consider altruistic about one's life, about how to deal with a situation, right? And yet, if we do not hold it, right, and cultivate it, it can quickly what? Just disappear. And we get covered over with worldly concerns. So he says, bodhicitta, again, this is this desire to be awake, to be enlightened, to manifest all the love and understanding, compassion of oneself for the benefit of all beings. This is bodhicitta. The awakened mind is known, in brief, to have two aspects. First, aspiring, bodhicitta in intention, and then active bodhicitta, practical engagement. As corresponding to the wish to go, and then the setting out, the wise should understand respectively the difference that divides the two. Okay, so he's clearly delineating the two aspects of this. First is what? It has to arise first in our mind. It has to become an intention. It has to become an aspiration. It has to become something that we really want to do. Right? That's has to be number one. Number two is then actively doing it. But one comes before the other. He says, from when? For bodhicitta and intention, great results arise for those still turning the wheel in the wheel of life. Yet merit does not rise from its ceaseless streams, as is the case with active bodhicitta. So he says, yes, it's good. In all that goes on in one's life, that the intention arises. But he says that is nowhere near as meritorious as the one who actively then lives it. Okay, so he's saying both are important, but of the two, you know, if you only have the one but never activate it, it is not as meritorious. For when with irreversible intent the mind embraces this this bodhicitta, this heart of awakening, willing to set free the endless multitudes of beings, in that instant, from that moment on, a great and unremitting stream of strength of wholesome merit, even during sleep and inattention, rides equal to the vastness of the sky. So you may say, now what the hell does that mean? That one has the intention to free all beings. To liberate all beings, right? You might say that's, you know, I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of grandiose, isn't it? It's also totally unattainable, isn't it? So why would one, in one's mind, want to be of benefit and help everyone? Could you think why? First of all, it's a very vast vow, isn't it? My own sense is, if I have set the intention in my mind to be of benefit to everyone, right, irrespective of who they are and who, you know, how they treat me or what they're doing, but irrespective, then I have to, if I'm practical, what? That if I vow to help everyone, that means that every particular person I meet is one of those everyones. Right? Usually it doesn't work that way, does it? Usually we dispense our kindness and our understanding and our patience on a very few. Right? People in our family, people we're close to, people who agree with us, people of our own country, our own ethnic group, our own religious group. You know, most of us dispense our willingness to be of benefit and help and to ease the suffering of another to very narrow streams, right? But if I have unrestricted set my intention that I will treat all beings as my family, right? All beings as my mother and father, all beings as my children, all beings as my first cousins, you know, whichever way you conceptualize it, right? Then that really, you know, when the vow is that vast, then all the particulars, right, fit into that. Am I making myself clear? So it may sound kind of extreme and grandiose and beyond, you know, beyond anybody's capacity. But to set that intention in your heart then implies that all your encounters, with not only with family and friends, with everyone at work, with everyone you encounter in the street, to strangers, to whatever, to people you read about in the paper, your intention for all of them is what? I want their suffering to end. I want to help in some way. Right? And then the way you act with people comes from that place to the best of your ability. Right? Because you are what? You're someone who is walking this path. So this, it's kind of unusual. I mean, or do you think this is very ordinary, this bodhisattva? I mean, I'm serious when I say that. I mean, I think it's quite extraordinary. Because it really unites, I think, two things that are often not united. Or even of the two things not united, most people never even think of it. But even for people who think of it... Usually people who follow kind of a meditative wisdom, self-transformation path, and those who follow a path of moral conduct and being helpful, activism, service to others, you know, usually they are two different paths. In the bodhisattva path, they become the same. Right? Become the same. The less self there is here, the less self-centeredness there is here, the more peace and understanding, compassion, et cetera, there is here, the greater is my capacity to benefit others. Right? They go together. And we see that, many of the great people that everyone mentioned earlier. I would imagine most of them had, either formally or informally, this kind of aspiration in their heart. Or they couldn't be doing what they're doing. Right? Because to these kind of people, to be so selfless in their caring for others and to be so fearless, as many of them have to be. And many of the people that we named just now were people who at the time were not often thought that highly of by many people in the society. Many of them were jailed, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What could have motivated them to continue in their path other than a deep love? And compassion for the suffering of their fellow beings. Right? So, if one with kindly generosity merely has the wish to soothe the aching head of another being, such merit knows no bounds. No, then, to speak then of the wish to drive away the endless pain of each and every living being, bringing them unbounded excellence. Could our father or our mother ever have such a generous wish? Do the very gods harbor such benevolence as this? The aim to bring about the benefit of all beings, a benefit that others wish, not even for themselves. This noble jewel-like state of mind arises truly wondrous, never seen before. Poetry. So let me stop here. I just wanted to, maybe over the coming weeks, dip in a little bit other places, but I know that many of you here are not part of the intensive, but I want to let you know about the way of the Bodhisattva, Shantideva. You may be interested in finding out more about yourself or reading this wondrous text. I'm sure you could go online and Google it and find all kinds of references and probably text. Any questions about this before I end tonight? Well, thank you for putting up with me.